that they said they were familiar with the study already, and the results were sort of days old, and they had already begun to fold those into the testing requirements that they were going to use for future qualifications of end system devices. So there's more to be done down this path, but my hope is that if we were reviewing these results in, say, 12 months' time, that a very different picture would emerge. Chicken and egg problems. Why should I sign my zone if there's no validator that's checking them? Why should I validate and try to check any signatures if there's no zones to be signed? So we're on the wrong end of the virtuous cycle. But I think that there's now enough forward movement so that we will get past that. We need zones signed, and we need validators checking them. The Kaminsky bug has been the Kaminsky. It's not really his bug, right? He just tracked it down and made it famous. Raised the attention of cache poisoning and the need for strong solutions. And so there is, I believe, a stronger movement toward getting zones signed. And we're now seeing the other thing that Comcast said was that they had mounted a resolver that their customers could use that would do validation. We already have the pioneering work done here by Telia on running recursive resolver that's checking validation. And I'm beginning to see comparable efforts. University of California, Berkeley, for example, is doing the same thing. We're working with folks in India, the Indian government, and the .in top-level domain headed down the same path. And I think the same sort of thing will happen. A different chicken and egg problem is, well, why should I sign my zone if my parent isn't signed? That's very often the refrain from top-level domain operators, not here, of course, but elsewhere. Until the root is signed, what difference does it make? The complementary problem is, why should I sign my zone, where my zone might be the root or might be a top-level domain, because nobody below me really cares about this, and so where's the pressure to do that? And so you could get into a deadly embrace waiting for pressure in either direction. My view on these two problems is let's get as many zones signed as we can, and let's get them signed opportunistically, up, down, sideways, inside, outside, and start the momentum to fill in the pieces. That leads to the pragmatic question of, okay, if you get a substantial number of zones that are signed and their parents are not signed so that there's no natural place to put the key, how do you communicate the key to people who want it? And the other side of that same coin, how do resolvers find all of the secure entry points, the tops of these chains, that is the zones that are signed whose parents aren't signed? And in my view, that raises a very strong need for organized, effective trust anchor repository. So as I said, we need a way to distribute the keys of the signed zone with unsigned parents. Resistance has come from multiple directions for multiple reasons. Oh, it's an additional structure, requires more work, it's not standardized, it's another trust model. And as I indicated in running through the RSTEP report, it might last too long, either as an entire entity or on an individual case-by-case basis. My pushback on all of this is, well, if you have a trust anchor repository which is either complete or nearly complete in the sense of having the tops of signed chains, and the resolver is nowhere to go to pick it up and they trust it, all important conditions, then it means that we're good to go right now as is, and over a period of time, that as the tree gets filled in, the trust anchor repository will grow as there are more signed zones with unsigned parents, and then go through periodic reduction as a parent is signed and then takes over the burden of validating or of vouching for the keys under it. And the biggest of those will come when .com is signed, of course, because that's bigger than everything else. But very important steps along the way are each and every of the major top-level domains. I'm particularly appreciative of .se's pioneering work. .org is moving forward. There are proposals in front of the Department of Commerce in the U.S. for getting the root signed, and there are some important details within the competing proposals, but one of the kind of almost sideways comments in VeriSign's cover letter is that they say that they will be ready to sign .com and .net within 18 months, I believe. And that is the first time that I have seen any public statement from them, and that I think will make a huge difference. Lots of things to discuss about Trust Anchor repositories. We have a paper out, a statement of needed internet capabilities, Trust Anchor repository, which comments are solicited, and I urge people who to take a look at it, read it, and comment on it. So a different area which I've mentioned is registrars, and registrars serve two related purposes here. One is they are the pathway for conveying information from a registrant up to the registry. Quite obviously, the name servers that the registrant is using, the whois information, and so forth. But the most important detail within all of that is that many, many small businesses and individuals who have domain names don't have any clue what it means to run their own name service. And in fact, they don't. The registrar frequently runs it. Now, there's other outsourced name service operations, ISPs, web hosters, and so forth. And for the purposes of what I'm saying here, you can include them within this. But the registrars, I think, are the primary. So when it comes to signing a zone, there are two very important and quite different sub-cases. One is, if I have a business and competent people and we run our own, we have a CIO and we have a network administrators and we have our own name servers, then when it comes to signing the zone, we'll take care of it. We'll mount DNSSEC on our name servers and sign our zone. And then we have to communicate the key upward through the registrar to the registry. And the registrar is then in the position of having to have the capability to accept the keying information from the business and having the capability of passing that information up to the registry, assuming the registry is also signed and is ready to take keys. On the other hand, registrars will also want to offer a signing process on top of the name service that they offer to the ones that they are hosting. So almost all registrars offer name service and take care of all of the details of administering and maintaining the zones for their customers who choose to avail themselves of that service. And if they add DNSSEC capability, then they will do the key generation and have to pass those keys upward. Mark Beckett from Secure64 talked about their product, which one of the constraints they concerned about was how to have a product that can handle generating keys for thousands and thousands of zones rather than just having to deal, for example, with one large zone. from a numbers point of view, any time there is a point of aggregation, as there is in a registrar that is running a lot of zones for somebody else, for its customers, the introduction of DNSSEC will lead to a large number of signed zones relatively rapidly. I was having a hallway discussion here, and there was some thought that this phenomena in Sweden could lead to perhaps if I heard correctly, something on the order of 20% of the zones under .SE signed, and I apologize if I've got that wrong. But instead of it being very small numbers, it could be very substantial numbers, and it could happen relatively quickly. We're working with a very small registrar to make sure that there is a pathway up to .org and to any other registry that they deal with. And in our dealings with them, we're working on both sides of that equation. And they actually have the major pieces working, not yet ready for prime time, but you know, in the shop, the stuff is turning over. It's not all that complicated, and I'm very pleased to see that progress. The last area that I touched on was IPv4, IPv6 translation. We all have seen the graphs that IPv4 address space is coming to an end in the sense that there won't be new addresses available. That does not mean in any way that IPv4 service is going to be shut down. I think we're going to see IPv4 service in operation more or less indefinitely. I would easily predict that it will outlast my lifetime and perhaps the rest of your lifetimes as well. And on the other hand, we will have to see the rapid expansion of IPv6 service. Those two statements, the persistence of IPv4 and the rise of IPv6, inevitably leads to the question of how those networks interact with each other. And there is, over the past year or so, I've seen quite a lot of activity on various forms of translation boxes. I see Anne-Marie, which is a signal that... 2 minutes? Good. Okay. Those strategies for having these networks interact with each other inevitably involve some form of rewriting or copying of the packets. And then the question comes up, how does DNS play in all of this? For example, one design for a box is for one of these protocol and address translation boxes is I go and ask for a service, and I'm on a V6 only network, and the response that comes back from the DNS lookup is a V4 address, and there's no V6 service available to it, for example. So this box then acts as a kind of a proxy, not just for the DNS, but for the entire service, and generates a local V6 address. I don't know any better, and I connect to that V6 address, and it translates the V6 packets that I'm generating into V4 packets and sends those out, and vice versa. What am I to make of the address, I'm sorry, of the response?